particular interest in the meaning that lies behind myths and fairy stories, and today he's talking about The Wizard of Oz.
Dorothy lived in the midst of the great Kansas prairies with Uncle Henry, who was a farmer, and Aunt Em, who was the farmer's wife. Their house was small, for the lumber to build it had to be carried by wagon many miles. There were four walls, a floor, and a roof, which made one room. And this room contained a rusty-looking cooking stove, a cupboard for the dishes, a table, three or four chairs, and the beds. Uncle Henry and Aunt Em had a big bed in one corner, and Dorothy a little bed in another corner. There was no garret at all, and no cellar, except a small hole dug in the ground called a cyclone cellar, where the family could go in case one of those great whirlwinds arose, mighty enough to crush any building in its path. It was reached by a trapdoor in the middle of the floor, from which a ladder led down into a small, dark hole.
How the story begins. You might not have read the book, but chances are you'll know the story just the same. Its real popularity, says John Algio, came through the 1939 Judy Garland movie. The story became part of American folklore, to the extent that it's been described as the archetypal American fairy tale.
Well, it's not entirely an American fairy story. In many ways, it's a universal story because it deals with themes that are of interest to all human beings. But it does have some typical American characteristics. For example, the author, Frank Baum, was very much interested in gadgets, in gimmicks. This appears in the story in the character of the Tin Woodman. The Tin Woodman is a figure who was originally a flesh and blood person, but had a spell put upon his axe so that every time he used it, he cut off a portion of his body, an arm or a foot, and had that portion of his body replaced by a tin substitute. Eventually, he became composed entirely of tin, so he was the first bionic man. This kind of interest in mechanical gadgets is, I think, American. The essence of the story, the moral of the story, if it has a single moral, is that every person, you and I, and every individual in the world, has the ability to do whatever they want to do, that it takes only the determination and the resolve and the realization that we can accomplish what we want to accomplish. And that, I think, is also a characteristic that grows out of the American experience with the frontier and the movement west. The three characters in the story who are companions to Dorothy each represent a dominant characteristic. The Scarecrow represents intellect, cleverness in solving problems. The Tin Woodman represents compassion and concern and consideration. And the Lion represents courage and the willingness to do and to try to overcome difficulties. So that these are the qualities that are put forth as being most significant and most important in human beings. And all of them are qualities that involve overcoming some kind of obstacle.
But those characters, the Scarecrow, the Tin Woodman, and the Lion, are essentially peripheral. The real focus of the story is the little girl, Dorothy.
Yes, I think she's every person. Dorothy is meant to be you and me. She's meant to be the reader. We are to identify with Dorothy, and we're to go through the experiences that she has.
Dorothy looked at him in amazement, and so did the Scarecrow.
Did you groan? Asked Dorothy.
Yes, answered the Tin Man. I did. I've been groaning for more than a year, and no one has ever heard me before or come to help me.
What can I do for you? She inquired softly, for she was moved by the sad voice in which the man spoke.
Get an oil can and oil my joints, he answered.
They're rusted so badly that I can't move them at all. If I'm well oiled, I'll soon be all right again. You'll find an oil can on a shelf in my cottage. Dorothy at once ran back to the cottage and found the oil can, and then she returned and asked anxiously, "Where are your joints?" "Oil my neck first," replied the Tin Woodman. So she oiled it, and as it was quite badly rusted, the Scarecrow took hold of the tin head and moved it gently from side to side until it worked freely, and then the man could turn it himself. "Now oil the joints in my arms," he said, and Dorothy oiled them, and the Scarecrow bent them carefully until they were quite free from rust and as good as new.
Conventions and themes, according to Professor Algio, that you can expect to find in any really good fairy tale.
In fairy stories generally, there are two main plots in most fairy stories. One of them is the plot of a quest in which the central character, the hero or the heroine, leaves home, has something to achieve, something to accomplish, some quest to follow. Often receive aid from other persons along the way, perhaps supernatural persons in the fairy tale, achieves the quest at the end, and then returns home, bringing with him or her the results of that journey, of that quest. And this, of course, is the basic plot of The Wizard of Oz. Dorothy begins at home in Kansas, goes to Oz. Her quest is to find her way back home again. She does so in the end, returning to Oz. The other main theme in fairy tales is the marriage motif, in which there is a man and a woman. One of them is under a spell or has an obligation or some kind of heavy restriction laid upon him or her. That restriction is removed, the spell is broken by the other member of the couple, and this fairy tale always ends then in a marriage. In the movie, and most people know the story nowadays through the movie, not through the book, but in both the book and the movie, one finds a series of obstacles that Dorothy has to overcome. When she lands in Oz, her house lands on top of the Wicked Witch of the East, killing her and liberating the people of that land. Then, in order to get back home, the wizard requires that Dorothy must first go into the West and kill the Wicked Witch of the West, who represents another kind of evil that Dorothy faces. And all through the story, we have a series of such obstacles which must be overcome. The assumption of the story is, of course, that the hero or heroine can always overcome any obstacle.
Even with eyes protected by the green spectacles, Dorothy and her friends were at first dazzled by the brilliance of the wonderful city. The streets were lined with beautiful houses, all built of green marble and studded everywhere with sparkling emeralds. They walked over a pavement of the same green marble, and where the blocks were joined together were rows of emeralds, set closely and glittering in the brightness of the sun. The window panes were of green glass. Even the sky above the city had a green tint, and the rays of the sun were green. The guardian of the gates led them through the streets until they came to a big building, exactly in the middle of the city, which was the Palace of Oz, the great wizard.
All the action so far has taken place in the course of that perilous journey the friends make in search of the Emerald City. Or is the search for the wizard himself?
In fact, the goal in the book is neither the wizard nor the Emerald City. The goal is Kansas. The goal is to get back to Kansas. The wizard and the Emerald City are both regarded ambivalently in the story. The wizard is, in fact, a humbug in the story. He's really a man who ran a balloon in the state of Nebraska, which is just to the north of Kansas. He took people up for balloon rides. And one day a strong wind came and blew him all the way to the land of Oz, and when he came down in the middle of the country, the Ozians assumed that anybody who came out of the sky had to be a wizard. He learned that there were four witches living in the country, and was so afraid of them that he pretended to be a wizard in order to build the Emerald City and hide out from them. The Emerald City itself is ambivalent in that when anyone enters the Emerald City, they are required to put on a pair of green glasses, green spectacles, so that everything they see is green. Hence, the Emerald City would appear to be a kind of fraud. But the fact is that the city really is made of emeralds. And here Baum, I think, is criticizing political leaders and perhaps church leaders, in that there really is an Emerald City. It is truly made of emeralds. It is genuine. But the leader of the city lacks the confidence in the reality of his own city, and so requires his followers to wear unnecessary green spectacles to make the emeralds look green.
Promptly at 9 o'clock the next morning, the green-whiskered soldier came to them, and 4 minutes later, they all went into the throne room of the Great Oz. Of course, each one of them expected to see the wizard in the shape he'd taken before, and all were greatly surprised when they looked about and saw no one at all in the room. They kept close to the door and closer to one another, for the stillness of the empty room was more dreadful than any of the forms they'd seen Oz take. Presently, they heard a voice, seeming to come from somewhere near the top of the great dome, and it said solemnly,
"I am Oz, the great and terrible. Why do you seek me?"
They looked again in every part of the room, and then seeing no one, Dorothy asked, "Where are you?"
"I am everywhere," answered the voice. "But to the eyes of common mortals, I am invisible. I'll now seat myself upon my throne, that you may converse with me."
Indeed, the voice seemed just then to come straight from the throne itself. So they walked toward it and stood in a row. The lion thought it might be as well to frighten the wizard, so he gave a large, loud roar, which was so fierce and dreadful that the little dog jumped away from him in alarm and tipped over the screen that stood in a corner. As it fell with a crash, they looked that way, and the next moment all of them were filled with wonder, for they saw, standing in just the spot the screen had hidden, a little old man with a bald head and a wrinkled face, who seemed to be as much surprised as they were. The Tin Woodman, raising his axe, rushed toward the little man and cried out, "Who are you?"
"I am Oz, the great and terrible," said the little man in a trembling voice. But don't strike me, please don't, and I'll do anything you want me to."
All through the story, the wizard is held up as the great and mighty Wizard of Oz. And the discovery that he is, in fact, an ordinary human being like you and me, and in fact, rather more ordinary than you and me, is meant to come as a shock. And that, too, is a very important point, and perhaps an American, although perhaps also a New Zealand point, namely that authority figures are not to be trusted implicitly. They are not to be looked up to without critical eyes, that those in authority are simply ordinary persons like you and me, with feet of clay. They are, in fact, if we insist on thinking of them as great and powerful, mighty figures, they will prove to us to be humbugs, as the wizard was.
had strong feelings about the horror and violence in most traditional fairy stories, and he believed he'd written one free of all heartaches. In fact, his publisher boasted that no Baum story ever sent a child to bed to troubled dreams. Even so, some parts are pretty frightening.
Some of the monkeys seized the Tin Woodman and carried him through the air until they were over a country thickly covered with sharp rocks. Here they dropped the poor woodman, who fell a great distance to the rocks, where he lay so battered and dented that he could neither move nor groan. Others of the monkeys caught the scarecrow and with their long fingers pulled all of the straw out of his clothes and head. They made his hat and boots and clothes into a small bundle and threw it into the top branches of a tall tree. The remaining monkeys threw pieces of stout rope around the lion and wound many coils about his body and head and legs until he was unable to bite or scratch or struggle in any way. Then they lifted him up and flew away with him to the witch's castle, where he was placed in a small yard with a high iron fence around it so that he couldn't escape. But Dorothy they didn't harm at all. She stood with Toto in her arms, watching the sad fate of her comrades and thinking it would soon be her turn. The leader of the winged monkeys flew up to her, his long, hairy arms stretched out and his ugly face grinning terribly. But he saw the mark of the good witch's kiss upon her forehead and stopped short, motioning the others not to touch her.
"We dare not harm this little girl," he said to them, "for she is protected by the power of good, and that is greater than the power of evil. All we can do is to carry her to the castle of the wicked witch and leave her there."
Baum said in the introduction to the book that he intended to write a fairy story for modern children, a fairy story which would not have in it the horror and the fright that so many traditional stories did. But the fact is, he wrote a fairy story which does have in it a good bit of horror and fright. However, about Baum's fairy story, as about any good traditional fairy story, one can say that the horror and the fright are not really horrible to children or frightening to children, because there is the guarantee within the story that at the end, the good will be rewarded and the evil be punished. And that's the way all good fairy stories work. As long as the child knows that this is going to be the outcome, horror and violence along the way are no problem for children. And these traditional fairy stories, like Baum's, were originally intended, of course, to be told by parents to children. And so there is the secure environment of the mother or the father telling the story to the child, and the trust which the child has in the family, in the mother or the father, in the family situation, means that you can take quite a lot of scariness.
It seems almost too easy for today's scholars to analyze and pigeonhole what's essentially a story to entertain children. Is it really fair to read in the allegorical overtones?
Certainly it is not the case that Baum sat down and said, "I'm going to write an allegorical story in which I will let the reader be represented by a little girl called Dorothy, and I will let the characteristics of intelligence and of compassion and of bravery be represented by three companions of Dorothy's, a scarecrow and a tin woodman and a lion." No, I don't think Baum did that at all. But Baum was steeped in a certain view of life, a view of life that appears in the story, a view of life which I refer to as theosophy. And Baum was a member of the Theosophical Society at the time he wrote this story and had been for some years. He told stories to his four sons, who were very fond of their father. Whenever any of the four boys had any problem, a skin, knee, or any kind of difficulty, they always ran to their father rather than their mother for comfort. And Baum used to tell bedtime stories to his sons at night. His stories got very famous in the neighborhood, so that all the neighborhood children came to hear the stories. One night, he told a story which he recognized as being unusually good, unusually effective. So after he put his sons to bed, he sat down and wrote out the outline of that story, and the next day he started writing a fuller version of it, and when he got done, he showed it to his mother-in-law, who was a very important figure in his life, and she said to him, in effect, "Frank, boy, I think you got something there. Why don't you go publish that?" So Frank Baum set about finding a publisher for his story of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and he did so in the year 1900, which was the year it was published, and it was the best-selling children's book in the United States in that year. Well, out of that that spontaneous telling of a bedtime story came a story which has, I think, levels of symbolic meaning, and they are there because Frank Baum was telling a story out of his own subconscious. That story was a fairy tale. Fairy tales have certain plots, certain symbols in them, and those appear, I think, in The Wizard of Oz. So I think the moral of the story is clearly there.
Earlier this year, the United States Supreme Court threw out a lawsuit brought against the use of a series of reading books in primary schools. Suspect titles included The Diary of Anne Frank and, guess what, The Wizard of Oz. John Algeo sees elements that could engender criticism.
The basic idea in The Wizard of Oz is that the individual is capable of doing whatever he or she wants to, that there is no limit on what we can accomplish if we set our minds to it. There is strong emphasis in the story on the power and the self-sufficiency of the individual. Now, some groups object to that because they want to see basically the individual as dependent on some external power or authority in the world. And clearly the book does criticize authority. It makes fun of the wizard who is a humbug. It does not take authority seriously.
Was a member of the Theosophical Society, and he'd been accustomed to writing about theosophy in a newspaper he edited for a while in South Dakota. It's possible that all that had quite an influence on the story.
I think this story, in fact, is a kind of theosophical allegory, in that it's a story of the soul coming into the world as Dorothy comes into Oz. This world is a beautiful, enticing, enchanting, and somewhat dangerous place, just as Oz is. We have adventures in this world, just as Dorothy did in Oz. Most of us have a nagging feeling somewhere in the back of our minds that we really want to go home, wherever that is, just as Dorothy wants to go home to Kansas the entire time she's in Oz. And theosophical teaching is that every individual has the ability to do that, that you and I and every person have upon our feet, as it were, silver shoes that will carry us back home to Kansas whenever we're ready to go. So that in this sense, I think Baum was, in fact, writing a fairy tale which has theosophical themes all through it. It is necessary to have a full set of experiences in Oz. Dorothy covers the entire land of Oz. She experiences practically everything there is to experience in the land before she returns home. And perhaps that's what we need to do in this world, too. What Baum was saying in that book, and indeed what theosophy teaches, is that every individual has the ability to overcome whatever obstacles, whatever evil lie in his or her path, and find our own way back to Kansas.
Aunt Em had just come out of the house to water the cabbages when she looked up and saw Dorothy running toward her.
My darling child, she cried, folding the little girl in her arms and covering her face with kisses. Where in the world did you come from?
From the land of Oz, said Dorothy gravely. And oh, Aunt Em, I'm so glad to be at home again.
In that program, Professor John Algio of the University of Georgia was talking about the meaning lying behind the fairy story of The Wizard of Oz. The reader was Robert Taylor, and Harold Arlen's music was arranged and conducted by Shorty Rogers with his orchestra. The program was produced and presented by Jan Swass.